Today's podcast is brought to you by Verve, the makers of the Arc, simple, elegant, effective solution for neck pain, soreness, and headaches. Check out the Arc on Kickstarter.com. Hello and welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Chirakabrad here as always with my buddy and partner in crime, Dr. Joe Palmer. How are you doing today, Joe? Sorry, with just hopes of reaching out some people and sharing some information. And we're getting close to 20,000 subscribers, so it's been fantastic support and very positive, and we appreciate that. So, as always, anything you guys want to know and any feedback you have, we are more than happy to hear. But the reason we're here today is to speak with the one and only, I think. I haven't seen too many Stefanias. Stefania Bell, the wonderkind physical therapist that does injury analysis for ESPN and writes, if I may say, very, very detailed descriptions on ESPN about injuries and injury progressions that I've learned a few things. So welcome to the show, Stefania.
Thanks so much for having me.
We, I know Joe and I are big football fans, and we're Ravens fans, and I know you watched the game on Monday night because I saw your tweet about Justin Tucker.
About Justin Tucker, the Renaissance man.
He is a Renaissance. Voice of an angel, let me tell you. Don't get me started on his voice, from his foot.
Apparently the leg of one, too.
Well, that's, yeah, I guess if you care about that kind of stuff. I know you do. You work a lot with football, and you see a lot of football injuries. So one of the things I was always curious about with injury analysis is, as a PT, our main goal is movement analysis, is understanding the function of injuries. So when you see an injury happen, what is the first thing that goes through your mind? Is it when are they going to get in the field, or how are they going to recover, and how does that translate to fantasy football?
Well, that's intuitive because of just practicing for so long. But one of the beauties of watching sports on TV is that I have the ability to go back and look at how the injury happened to the extent that we can see it. You know, it always depends on whether you have a good angle on the injury, but I have this lovely tool called NFL Rewind where you can go back and watch the games and you can get certain angles, and it does help to see the injury. And sometimes to see what they're looking at, you know, sometimes when the cameras are capturing like what they're looking at on the side of the field, how the player might be testing it. So I just try to gather as much information as I can from the bit that we can see, and then essentially tracking what the players are doing from the tests that they're going through to what they're doing in terms of practice, because a large percentage of the audience I speak to during football is fantasy football oriented. The one thing they care about the most is, when is my guy coming back?
Right.
And I like to think that people are interested in learning more about the injuries themselves. I think when you start explaining why it is that a guy is out, why it is that maybe he's not coming back as quickly as somebody hoped, why is this injury so problematic, and people can understand it, they actually get a little less frustrated by and large.
That's a great point. One of the things I see a lot of times in terms of injury descriptions is they say, oh, he has or she has this and that out 6 to 8 weeks. Well, I don't think people really grasp what 6 to 8 weeks really means, whether it's healing times or functional return. So if somebody gets injured, what does that actually mean? So let's say they sprain their ankle and they see 4 to 6 weeks out. Is that injury healing time, or is that actually them going back to 100%?
Oh, there are so many layers to these injury projections that you see. First of all, you're dealing with professional athletes who, let's just stick with football because it's easier. I think for different sports, it's different.
Sure.
And when you're talking about football, you're talking about a very limited season. You know, you've only got 16 games in the regular season. Everybody has to make a push during those 16 games. So the ideal notion that you're playing with healthy players after literally about the third week is crazy because everybody who plays professional football is hurt to some degree. And by the time you get to the point, the season where we're at right now, coming into the final weeks, everybody's banged up. So my favorite question that people like to ask me is, can I count on so-and-so? Will he be 100% healthy? And I'm thinking, nobody's 100% healthy at this point. So the return times are a combination of when realistically is a team projecting that a player will return from said injury, keeping in mind that projections tend to be a little conservative, meaning they're going to give an outer limit so that if a player comes back sooner, that's fantastic. And usually they're not going to be out longer than what they project, because that's when the teams start having to deal with annoying questions from the media saying, well, you said 4 to 6 weeks, we're going into week 7, what's wrong? And as you know, it's very difficult to project healing times across different people, even if it's the same injury. I think that's one thing the listeners who and the audience who I speak to have learned over time, is that no two injuries are identical. And even within the same player, a similar injury can behave differently.
Now, you've mentioned these are professional athletes. Have you seen a difference in healing between professional athletes versus just average patients?
Yes, they definitely come back quicker. But I don't know if that's always healing in the sense that they're fully recovered, or still what we're talking about, where they're getting back because they have to be in competition before they're 100% healthy. And one thing I used to hear all the time when I was still doing a fair amount of clinical practice was, why does it take me, this is average weekend warrior patient, why does it take me 2 months to get back from this, and the guy playing football is back on the field in 2 weeks or 1 week? And I would say, well, because he only has 16 weeks a year to perform his job. He is working under a contract that depends on him participating in the sport. He may not be 100% when he's going back. He's carrying an injury risk, and he's rehabbing around the clock when he's not playing, because his job is to participate in a sport. And he is not like a weekend warrior who's got a life and needs to be productive in a job outside of that sport. So a lot of different parameters that they're dealing with, which makes it an unfair comparison, really, between an average person and a professional athlete.
Joe, right? Unlike you, when you have your flag football tournament and then you're out for about 2-3 weeks, can't treat patients, yeah?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Joe is obviously, like a professional athlete, has to rehab around the clock.
Oh, absolutely. So. We got to get him back there. His team will not survive.
Well, that's a good point. I get the same kind of questions, Stefania. And I think what people don't realize is that they are carrying that injury risk back onto the field, and that they probably aren't fully healthy when they initially start back. And I think that's a good point that you make there.
And it's interesting, because even within the professional athlete world, there are people who have crazy healing powers, like Adrian Peterson, who I think is unlike just about anyone else that I've seen. And then there are guys who are injured all the time, and you've seen it. You know that this happens, and people will ask, why is this guy injured all the time? And I do think there are differences in collagen, just like we see in everybody else. So some people have poor tissue quality and they're just more susceptible to injury, or they've had a certain number of injuries in their past that predispose them to other types of injuries. Maybe their nutrition isn't as great. I hear things about some players who maybe are out a lot and don't get as much sleep as they should, or who aren't maybe taking as good care of themselves. You see the guys who are really fit. I mean, look at Tony Gonzalez for the Atlanta Falcons. Mm-hmm. Incredibly healthy, has a great diet, really on top of his just maintaining his overall fitness and his mental and physical health. Really doesn't get hurt very often. And even at his age, in advanced age in football, he's had a remarkable career where he's barely missed a game. So there are certainly differences even amongst the professional athletes. You've got them being at the elite percentage of the population, but then within that group, there are still guys who heal much better than others.
Yeah, I think we see pretty commonly in the clinic, we have patients that live their lives, and you know, most people don't want to be in pain. But I think as you've mentioned, that professional athletes are essentially always living in some state of pain or discomfort. So you know, when somebody asks why are they playing, they're playing, but that doesn't mean they're playing pain free or completely without discomfort. Just as you are probably going to work with a little ache here and there.
Right. I mean, especially during the season, I think they count on their off season being a big recovery time. And they expect that when they're in the throes of the regular season, they're not going to be 100%. They're just trying to maintain.
Yeah, I'd probably get out there if I had a few million dollars on the line as well.
It's certainly a high motivator. I mean, they're also, there's a level of competitiveness. And I think just intrinsically that there's a percentage of them that are extremely highly motivated, but all of that works together. I mean, that's why they got to where they are, really.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it, you can make a case that it comes back to when they get started, you know, youth sports, and a lot of these, I think the statistic was 1% make it to the professional sports or something, very, very small percentage. And usually, even early on, they're kind of the standouts of the sport. So sometimes they don't have to be perfect with their mechanics and their training, and they just kind of go through the rest of the levels of sports until they get to that professional level, and then they find out, hey, I'm playing with the rest of the 1%, and that's when the injuries can start piling up. But speaking of injuries, what are some of the most common injuries you would say you see in football?
They're kind of clustered into different categories. We certainly see the soft tissue injuries, that the wear and tear injuries that happen over the course of a season. And some of that's defined by position more than anything else. The wide receivers end up with hamstring strains and groin strains more commonly than anything else. The running backs take such a beating. They're dealing with contusions and bruises from helmets and hits, a fair number of concussions, also dealing with soft tissue wear and tear injuries and ankle sprains from getting caught in piles, mm-hmm. occasional knee injuries. And then you get the blowout injuries. Quarterbacks deal with shoulder and head injuries. Those are the two most common because of the way they get taken to the ground. And so they end up with separated shoulders or fractured collarbones like Aaron Rodgers is dealing with now, or concussions. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing, you know, concussions certainly have a spotlight on them in the NFL and everywhere else now. They probably happened as frequently, but weren't documented as frequently as they are now. And then there, just because it's a high impact, a high energy collision sport, we get the gruesome knee injuries, the dislocated knees, the multi-ligament knee injuries, the dislocated elbows. We've had a couple of those this year. Bizarre injuries that you don't see. Sometimes you only see them in motor vehicle accidents, and yet you see them on the football field. That dislocated sternoclavicular joint. The rare things, but they still happen.
And when you talk about these injuries, for the PTs that might wonder whether treatment is any different on the professional level besides the sheer amount of time that the athlete can spend in the rehabilitation process, are there things that you see on the professional level that have yet to trickle down to, you know, standard PT clinics?
It's interesting, but not really. A lot of the types of treatment that they're receiving are very similar across the board. I've spent time, I was in Jacksonville this summer, right before the season, doing a piece on Maurice Jones-Drew, and spent the day in the training room with Mike Ryan, who's the head physical therapist and athletic trainer for the Jaguars. And their facility is beautiful because he got to help design it when they had the new facility. But in terms of what he's doing, it just looks like good physical therapy treatment that you would see in an outpatient practice. Now, they have fabulous equipment available to them. They have an amazing pool, an amazing HydroWorks pool with the treadmills, etc. And they might have more fancy equipment for the athletes to work out on. But in terms of the types of the things they're doing, it's very, very similar. I think the biggest difference is what we already alluded to, and that the athletes are there for so much time. So they really get kind of everything thrown at them. If you have a number of things you can do to address swelling, they're going to get it all. But in terms of the types of treatment, there's a lot of manual therapy going on. I have some friends who are physical therapists around the league who are doing a really good job with manual therapy. There is some dry needling being practiced. I have a couple colleagues who are doing that. Certainly all the cold and therapies, electric stim, you know, modality treatments are in use as well. But a lot of manual therapy, a lot of functional exercise. And the thing about the folks who are in that world of professional sports injury management is that they really understand the constraints they're working in. They understand that they're on a timetable, that some of the way, I think it's a lot about understanding injury management. Medical people, whether it's physicians or physical therapists, athletic trainers, anyone who's in that setting has to understand the complexities of returning a player to play in a constrained time frame. And right. I think that's very hard unless you practice in that setting, unless you get experience in that type of setting, to appreciate how difficult that is. Because for many of us, if you haven't been in that setting, you might think, oh, I couldn't possibly let this guy go back to that activity because it's still right. early, their X, Y, and Z hasn't happened yet. And these guys understand the difference between when somebody can play and is at low, relatively low risk. It's a very much a risk reward calculation, or when they really need to make a decision to hold someone out. And they have to also have really excellent communication skills because they're dealing with coaches, they're dealing with management of teams, and they have to be firm.
Right. And they're working as part of a team, right? I mean, every team has a physician, an athletic trainer, a physical therapist, a strength coach. I mean, they have all of those different parts, right?
Yes, but it's worth mentioning, and it's important to be really clear about it. The physicians are not employees of the team. So physicians are independent. Now, they are the physicians who are affiliated with the team in the sense that they're where they send the players. But they're not employed by the team. And that's very important because they need to be free to make their medical decisions, and they will swear to a person that they make them free of constraints and pressure by the team. It is different for the rehab staff, physical therapists, athletic trainers who are employees of the team. And so it's a slightly different role in that they're at the facility. They are members of that team, but obviously their communication with the team physicians, and there are multiple because most teams have primary care neurologist or some other neurological consultant affiliated with them, and maybe even another who's completely independent, orthopedic surgeon or two. And then there are other specialists that aren't part of every team. For example, Bob Anderson is a foot and ankle, board certified foot and ankle surgeon, orthopedic surgeon, who's based out of North Carolina, who has an affiliation with the Carolina Panthers, but is seen as the expert where a majority of NFL players with foot and ankle problems will consult with him regardless of what team they play for because of his expertise. So it's pretty complex system.
Now, you're obviously around this world a lot, and I know I get asked a lot about working with professional athletes and just being in that environment. Just from outside in and seeing all of this, would you say it's a difficult environment to be around in for everything you've mentioned? You know, we all have restraints, whether you're dealing with insurance companies or you're dealing with marketing. There's always something that's difficult, but when you're dealing with timetables of getting somebody to get back versus dealing with reimbursement issues, you think that's a bit of a different world, a little bit harder to deal with?
I don't know that I would say one's harder than the other, because as you said, they each present their own challenges. But I do think it's a very high-pressure situation. You have to be able to make decisions quickly and efficiently and confidently. And because of the particular season or timetable, you're always working under those constraints and the pressures of the budgets that exist. Now, you're talking about multi-million dollar players, and depending on the sport, and player contracts, and that's another thing. There's a lot of awareness about player contracts and where they are and how their standing might be. I mean, there are management issues that are circulating, and the medical folks have to be able to make their decisions on the one hand independent of that, meaning still being true to themselves as medical professionals and doing what's right from their perspective and for the health of the player, but still being mindful of what the constraints are of the team or the organization or where the player is in their contract or if they're in the process of going to another team and communicating with other teams. So it's just a whole different world. It's very, very tough to imagine it unless you actually work in it. I would highly recommend if anyone who's listening is young in their career and is interested in doing something like this that you intern with a team, even a college, like a Division I level team, because those are often functioning quite a bit like the pros. And you really just need to see what the constraints are to see if that's something you would enjoy. There are challenges with, I think people see the glamour side of it, like, oh, it's a professional team and you get to travel and you get to do all this. And it sounds fabulous, right? Until you see these guys are working for the rehab staffs who are with the NFL teams, they are on the clock literally 7 days a week for 17 weeks plus any time in the postseason plus training camps, OTAs, etc. So it's an exceptional commitment.
Yeah, and a football team is what, 52 players, right, on an active roster? So that's
right. And imagine how they're dealing with it when they're starting with the rosters now are expanded. They have 90 something players in the preseason. And wow, if you think about all the injuries we saw in the preseason this year, one of the reasons you're seeing more numbers is because you're dealing with more players. So think about how that trickles down to the medical staff in terms of their responsibility as well.
So one thing, let's say you have a player that gets injured, right? If you're a manual therapist, if manually trained like Joe and I are, we're always thinking about the cause of the problem. We're always thinking there's typically an underlying issue, especially right, with unilateral injuries. You know, when you see athletes strain their left hamstring versus their right or pull this, pull that, generally there is a proximal involvement like SI joint, L4-5, something along those lines. So as a therapist and you go, you know, speak to the coach or whoever you report to, and you tell them, yeah, that they pulled their hamstring, but it's coming from their spine. Is that an easy sell? Do you have the freedom to work that way, or they strain their hamstring, we need to fix their hamstring?
I think it's dependent on the organization. I think it's all relative to who the personnel is, and I certainly can't speak to every organization, but I can tell you, for example, the folks up in New England who take care of the Patriots, a lot of manual therapy going on there. And they actually did, there was a course that was done in Boston last year, which was really sports medicine in the NFL. Mm-hmm. A lot of different providers, physicians, physical therapists, and athletic trainers who are working with teams were presenting information. And there were clinicians in attendance who also worked with professional teams, but many who worked with high school athletes, college, sort of the gamut. And to hear, I do know the Patriots guys, one of their physical therapists, Joe Van Allen, went to University of Miami where I went to graduate school. We were not there at the same time, but know each other through that. And he's very, very big in manual therapy, knows a lot about spine, knows a lot about core rehab, is really excellent. Like, they're lucky to have him. And he was talking about that kind of work with some of their athletes, but understand that they get most of that in the off season. It's really tough in the middle of a season to try and get those things because you're really just trying to get from 1 week to the next. So to answer your question, I think they have buy-in because they've established credibility in terms of how good they are at treating their patients, the athletes. But they also know that they may not have an opportunity to address everything the way that they would like, ideally, during the course of a season. So there's a little bit of they have to make some decisions here and there about how they're going to attack something, depending what time of year it is.
Right. Sounds like it's a trade-off, and the quickest solution to the imminent problem, and then keep it in the back of your mind and fix the underlying issue, I guess, later, so it doesn't happen again. Sounds like.
Right. And I think they implement what they can along the way, but they're just in terms, when you think about how short the week is in terms of recovery from one game to be able to game plan and turn around and get ready for the next one, it's really short. Imagine if somebody got injured and came in to see you in the clinic and had to be fully functional a week later. Like, let's call it a minor injury. In other words, you wouldn't keep them out of playing, but they need to be back and doing their job a week later. They may not have a whole lot of time or capacity, just in terms of realistically how long it takes to retrain something, to completely accomplish that in that short of a time frame.
Yeah, and it's all about leeway. I know I treat I see Division One athletes that come around in the off season in the area that I work, and I had a female soccer player from a pretty big Division One program, and it was her off season, so she came in and she kind of had that. She had chronic hamstring strains, and it was because of facilitation from her SI joint. So we worked her pelvis, and she was getting better. And she would come in every 3 to 4 days, kind of flared up again. I was like, you know, what is going on? She's like, oh, yeah, I had, you know, 3 pickup games I just played. And I did, I think she said 90 minutes on the elliptical and this and that. And you're just kind of shaking your head going, this is your off season and you're doing what?
Right. I mean, it is hard to educate some of them about recovery. I often say that with the pros, sometimes when they have to go through a major surgery, that's when they really get better. We see a lot of baseball players who undergo Tommy John surgery who come out so much more fit and through their whole body, because they haven't had, if they've been pitching since they were kids, they really haven't had a break of that long since they were throwing. And so this allows them to not only give their body the downtime that it's probably needed for years, but a chance to go back and address other problems, which are undoubtedly contributory, but have never been addressed.
Well, you addressed a topic that we discussed in one of our myth episodes of, we get asked, hey, they just had Tommy John surgery. Are they stronger than they were before?
Well, the common phrase that I used to hear, and I treated a lot of youth pitchers a lot before I came here. So I rehabbed a number of Tommy Johns. What you would hear is that, and the disturbing part was when kids, and even in some cases their parents, were pushing for surgery because they felt they would come out able to throw harder on the other side, and educating them that really the result may be that pitchers do feel like they're throwing harder, but they're often throwing harder because they're throwing more efficiently. They're throwing better because of the way that they're throwing and all the retraining that they do. And most ulnar collateral injuries aren't blowouts. Most of them are debilitation over time, even if they do have a single episode that's kind of the straw breaking the camel's back. So they may not have been throwing well for a long time, and their perception is that they're throwing much harder when they come back. So debunking that myth is important, but it's important for people to understand why that's a myth too. And I've seen so many players say, once they had this rehab, that they really were able to address things that they never even knew were weak until they were forced to take that downtime and go through it.
Yeah, and that's great. That's one of my passions as well, is to try to educate young athletes and parents. And I particularly like the throwing athlete as well. So one of the things that I try to get across to them is especially with early specialization, and athletes are throwing year round in some climates, not in the climate that we're in where it gets cold and people have to rest. But, you know, the kids that are throwing, you know, 11, 12 months out of the year, and trying to really focus on getting them to take 2-3 months off from performing their main sport, and making sure that they cross train and do the other things that are necessary to be more efficient when they do return to their overhead throwing.
I can't even tell you how strongly I feel about this. I'm a big promoter of downtime for throwers, and it's interesting because I talked with John Smoltz once about this because he was helping kick off the STOP campaign that Dr. Andrews launched, really. And he was talking about growing up where you couldn't throw outdoors year round. There were big winters, and he played basketball, and he actually thought that he was going to be a basketball player. That was his favorite sport. That's what he thought he would do well. And it was funny because obviously he went down the path of baseball, and that worked out pretty well for him.
Yeah, he was all right.
He never pitched more than during baseball season. And was a big believer, played three sports, was a big believer in rotating sports and having that downtime. And that just came to him naturally. But Dr. Andrews always has this slide that he uses, which I like, which is a whole calendar. And he'll have it all highlighted in green. And then he has 1 week between Christmas and New Year's that's highlighted in red. And he says this is usually to reflect the calendar essentially of a thrower and say, this is the week off that he usually gets between Christmas and New Year's for a youth thrower. And it bothers him so much. I mean, he's so passionate about this himself. That's why he started the STOP campaign, was to try and educate kids and families about the dangers of overuse. And he tells them he does not want them doing an overhead sport for at least, he really wants it to be 3 months out of the year. So if they're a pitcher, they should not be doing even overhead swimming, like freestyle, where they're doing a crawl that's overhead. He wants them away from an overhead sport for 3 months out of the year.
Yeah, that's great advice, and I think that's great. I'm glad you brought up the STOP campaign, and I think that other PTs can use that as a resource. I also just want to plug another book that I really thought was great for kind of getting into the psyche of the parent, coach, player, and medical professional mindset is Until It Hurts by Mark Hyman. I don't know if you have read it, but it goes through and it talks about actually his story through his son who was playing as a pitcher in baseball, and he walks through kind of basically an elbow injury through his son, through his eyes, and how the different pressures are seen. He does a lot of interviewing of physicians and other professionals to get some true insight. I thought it was very, very poignant, and I've recommended it to a lot of my parents of young throwing athletes. So.
That's exactly who needs it. That's good.
If it were only that simple. Mm-hmm. I think I know we Joe and I both played baseball, and we both love baseball, and I know we see injuries a lot in the elbow and shoulder, and me personally, I think one of the biggest things that gets ignored, whether it's just something that's not looked at because not a lot of information on, or people just don't feel comfortable treating it, is the thoracic spine, and I think you see that starting in the youth, way down in the youth is. They overcompensate so much with their shoulders and their elbows, mainly because they're still growing into their bodies. They're too much kyphosis. They have poor extension of the thoracic spine, and you know their shoulder and their elbow become stuck between a rock and a hard place. So if you can't extend, if the thoracic spine isn't extending on the side that you're throwing, you're have to make up that motion somewhere, and it's going to be at the shoulder, it's going to be at the elbow. So it's an ongoing problem that has an underlying issue, and if you can't find it, you'll constantly be going through that loop of injury.
I could not agree more. I think it's interesting, a lot of the athletes that I put through rehab following Tommy John surgery, virtually all of them would end up with thoracic mobilization at some point, especially early on when they were limited in terms of what they're doing with their upper extremity. And to a player, they were like, wow, this feels so good. You know, they had really never addressed anything centrally or not very much. And I think really finding that they needed to engage their whole body. It was a learning process for them too. This is not just about rehabbing my elbow. And I talk to pros now. I go to spring training every year. It never fails. There's so many injuries. I'm always talking to a guy who's coming off Tommy John. And it's funny because this year I was at St. Louis Cardinals training camp, and I spoke with or spring training camp. I'm still in football mode. I was at spring training and talked with Adam Wainwright. And I always write about who I'm talking to during spring training and sort of what I'm thinking about the year ahead. And I had this great conversation with him. And obviously he'd come off the Tommy John surgery heading into not this past season, but the season prior. And he was talking about when he first got on the mound and what he first felt and how his arm didn't feel like his own, and kind of what it took until he felt like he was throwing like himself again, but how he had learned that a lot of guys coming off this surgery ended up with problems in their shoulders. It was really important for him to keep up his shoulder strength. It was really important for him to maintain a lot of the core strength that he'd done. And he talked about the mobility through his spine. And I wrote, and this was going into what year are we coming off of, 2013. It was going into this season. And I said, Adam Wainwright's going to have a great year because he understands what's going on in his arm. And he convinced me in spring training. I don't think he was trying to convince me, but he was clearly so knowledgeable about his body, and he had bought in and was doing everything he needed to, and he looked like he was throwing well. And I said, I really think he's going to have a great year. I didn't know he was going to be like Cy Young material here, but it was unbelievable. And I think that was a really great moment of insight into how, when a player really buys into the rehab process and they live it and they own that, how well they can do. And he was a great example of that.
Yeah, and I think the thoracic spine is one, like you said, you do the mobilization and almost instantly you have results. It's not a wait, 6 months. It might take that long to fully retrain the nervous system to have long lasting effects, but you do a thoracic manipulation and it's almost instantly you can see the improvement in shoulder motion and just overall mechanics. So it's great that it's at least trickling to that professional level. But if you train them young, if you educate them and they have an awareness of it's more than just my elbow, it's more than just my shoulder, it goes back a little further. And I think there's been a little bit of a movement in terms of that in our field with the Gray Cook, the functional movement stuff. I know they emphasize a lot of thoracic motion. So it's nice to see, but it's still nowhere near where it should be. We're more, I think most people look at symptoms versus figuring out why those symptoms appeared in the first place.
Well, that's one area where I think PTs can continue to help educate athletes, young athletes all the way up to, it's never too late, even for the adults, and the importance of sort of the whole body concept, really, in that you're not just symptom chasing for one area, but even though that's what people would, the patient would like to do because they just want to get rid of the problem that's annoying them at hand that's brought them in. But I think that's where PTs are so important, is helping educate people as to why it happened and hopefully helping avoid it happening again by understanding their bodies a little bit better.
Yeah, it's sticking to convictions best you can. We still are based on a referral system. So if you get a referral that says X, Y, or Z, and there's an underlying issue, do your best to communicate with the referring clinician, communicate with the patients, and stick to what you find. You are that person's clinician, and you might be as good as it gets for them. So sometimes you just got to stick to your guns.
Definitely.
And speaking of that, I know you do a lot of communicating with a vast majority of people that don't understand medical terms and medical knowledge. How hard is it, or was it for you, to see and think as a clinician but convey it in layman's terms? I know we all go through it talking to patients, but you have a little bit of a bigger audience than us.
And it's funny because it depends on the medium too. I have a little more freedom when I'm writing something if I want to go into more detail about it. And I write blog entries that are sometimes very short and quick, like we're doing in the middle of football season. But if a bigger injury comes about, then I'll dive into it a little bit more. But certainly I've done longer pieces when Derrick Rose got hurt, when Kobe Bryant got hurt, talking a little bit about what the plan is, what's the layout, what's the landscape for a rehab program coming off an injury like that.
I think that was my favorite piece that you wrote with the Achilles and writing about Kobe. I think that was excellent. I actually had some of my patients read that, so they
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm glad. So you're the one. No,
I'm glad. There's at least three. I promise. At least three.
And it does. You know, those are a lot of work. So it's always nice to know that people are reading it. But I do think there is a fine line. You don't want to write it at a level where the audience is just going to turn off because they're not interested in it. I take a great deal of pride in providing context. I follow sports exceptionally closely. I mean, I live it. This is what I do. So I'm very cognizant of the players, of their style of play. I understand the sports. I follow them. A lot of times I video follow them. I look at the injuries. If I watch the player enough, I know things about their style of play. And I think as long as you relate what a fan is interested in about an athlete to the injury, then that holds their interest. And I like to give the fans credit too. It's very easy to say, well, they don't have a medical background, they wouldn't be interested in this. But what I found, and this was actually one of the things that pushed me in the direction of what I do currently, when I was treating patients and doing some initial writing for fantasy sports on the side, people would say, oh, you know, so-and-so has that injury. That's the same thing I have. Like, they identified with the athlete. It made it seem cooler if they had the same injury as the professional athlete. So they wanted to understand what was happening to them relative to how it would impact a professional athlete. So, and I would say, based on some of the emails I get, responses I receive from people on Twitter, and people who might be commenting on something I've written, there's still a lot of that happens, and that is what engages the audience. So they are interested in some of the medical information because it satisfies their curiosity, whether it's just an athlete that they care about or they've had something similar happen to them and they'd like to understand it better. But that's the written format. When you're on television, you have maybe 60 seconds. Maybe.
Yeah, I'm always waiting for you to slip up with medical terms, by the way, when I'm watching fantasy football. I was like, come on, Stefania. Come on. Give me something.
That's not nice. I mean, are you kidding? That goes through my head too, is all the possible things that you could say wrong or slip up on television at live TV and not get that back. You don't necessarily
have. Like, come on, give me that L4-5 ridiculous symptoms. Yeah. And he has tingling. Ah, damn it, Stefania.
It's you have to convey something in a snapshot that's very, very quick when it's television. And you have to err on the side of saying maybe two or three points in a short time span. Hmm. And that was probably the hardest adjustment for me. And I still think at times it's difficult because sometimes I'll feel like, well, I didn't really say anything because, you know, I could talk with you guys, talk with peers, talk with, even spend time talking with a patient about an injury. And when you have time to go back and forth and answer questions and dialogue on it, you can get into some more of the specifics. When you're trying to explain in a matter of seconds what's going on with Derek Jeter and why he's not coming back and why a fractured ankle like that is so difficult to recover from and why is he out again, and you've got maybe 30 or 45 seconds to do it on live TV, that's really tough. And it's hard to say a lot. So you try and find two or three key things that somebody can take away from after they've heard you and hopefully hang on to that and feel like they've learned something. For me, the biggest compliment I get is if people say that they learned something that they didn't know before. And when we can provide that for the audience, then I feel like, you know, to me, that's the biggest satisfaction I get.
That's great. Is it, does it, I don't know how much you treat currently. Does it, Is it?
I really don't much anymore, other than consulting. I do some consulting intermittently, but just because of the nature of my schedule, I can't do regular ongoing treatment.
Right. Yeah. So do you miss that? Do you miss that clinic time?
I do, and I'm trying to find ways to do clusters of time because I still get back in the clinic. And like I said, I do some consulting and evaluative things. I still teach. I do some teaching, some manual teaching for some PTs locally. It's never enough. I was just on a shoot. I had a piece that aired on Baseball Tonight. And we had a Baseball Tonight Sports Center special from Winter Meetings, and I had a piece on Manny Machado. Someone up your way. He was down at University of Miami rehabbing, and we went down and shot footage of him rehabbing, and then I did an interview with him. And what was great about it was we caught him so early, and we're going to be tracking him as opening day approaches, but we did our first installment with him down in Miami. And when he was sitting on the table there, and I know the folks at University of Miami too, because I went to graduate school down there. So it was a very friendly shoot. We were having a good time, but I just had to touch his knee. I was like, I just had to put my hands on it and feel it and see how it was moving, because then I knew what I was dealing with. And I'm the one talking about him and talking to him. And it's funny because when I first got into this, I thought the players might retreat a little bit, thinking, oh, you know, she knows this, so I don't really want to say anything because I don't want to let on too much. You know, players tend to be pretty guarded, especially when it comes to injuries. I found it's exactly the opposite. They know that I get it, what they're going through. If they throw out a term, they know I'm familiar with it. If they've learned something in therapy, or I can engage in a conversation with them about what they're doing, and I understand it. And it's actually helped a lot of them open up to me and tell me things about what's going on in their rehab that I would bet nobody else has heard or they haven't shared, simply because it's hard to have that conversation with somebody who isn't familiar with it. So to answer your question, I do miss it in the sense that my hands miss doing that work, and I miss being involved in the one-to-one with patients, but I feel like I've just taken it. It's like a different vector. You know, I still apply the knowledge and I still get the interaction. It's just on a different level. And my hands are probably grateful that I'm not doing as much manual work now as I used to be.
So what you're saying is you throw in treatments during your interviews. So you're interviewing Manny Machado and doing patellofemoral mobs.
I'm mobilizing his patella at the same time. I know. I'm sure Lewis, his physical therapist who's working with him, would probably rather I didn't. But they sort of forgave me for that momentary jumping in and taking over.
Yeah, I'm sure. I know you mentioned the articles you wrote. And I think all you have to do is scroll down to the comments below the articles and just read a few of those, and you see the gamut of people that understand some of the medical terms, people that don't, and you can see just misconceptions flying left and right. I mean, it's pretty entertaining, but it's also almost a little sociologic experiment just reading comments after articles like that. Oh, yeah, I had this injury, I did this and that. My mom's friend's uncle had the same thing, and this worked for them. You know, and you see all kind of stuff like that.
Oh yeah, everyone's got an opinion and everyone's got an answer. It's you have to be careful with reading the comments section after any article. we learn that when we're in this line of work.
Do you see? Do you ever have any professional teams asking you for consultations?
No, I don't. I think, you know, because I'm media now, that is one thing that's tough. Is sometimes I want to be included in. I would like to hear what they're discussing at certain venues, because I think I could really report on this well and help bridge the gap to the public. And sometimes it's funny because I've had people say, oh, you've gone over to the dark side now. You're on the media side. And some of them are people I know from being in the sports medicine world before. So there is a line there and we all respect it. But obviously, because of some of the confidentiality issues, it's not really something that I'm doing. Now, I say that, but I still do speak I have spoken to audiences of physicians who are treating professional athletes and engaging with folks who are in that world based on some of the background of what I did before, but also even on topics of talking with the media, because I think more and more people on the healthcare side who deal with high-level athletes or high-visibility athletes are understanding the importance of being able to communicate with the media or people who are interested in getting into the same kind of work that I'm doing. And certainly there's room for a number of voices there. I think it always sounds great when there is a lot to learn about navigating that role. And so I'm always happy to share it with people because I'd like to see more folks out there who have, you know, good background in medicine, whether that's physical therapy or athletic training or as a surgeon or primary care, being able to help provide that translation for the lay audience.
Yeah, it's been great to watch you as a medium for physical therapy, because there's, like you said, there's not a lot. I can't think of any other prominent physical therapists that are mainstream, at least. I know I've seen some pop up on Dr. Oz and things like that, but they're just more stereotypes than anything, more kind of archaic thinking, just stretching and modalities and things like that, that really any good clinician's not really doing much of anyway. So it's always nice to have a clinician that still understands what's the science of it that's based on, but also can see the future and the perspective of it. And there, like you said, there's really not enough of it out there right now.
No, and I think
you're in a really unique position. I mean, unique position to promote the field and to make it recognizable to mainstream public.
Well, I hope so. And I do enjoy when people say, oh, I didn't know physical therapists knew about this, or I didn't know physical therapists knew that. And but there's a lot that physical therapists know that people might not be aware of. So if it helps with that kind of attention and visibility, then I'm all for it. And it's funny because now I work at ESPN. I get the hallway consult requests all the time, just like you would anywhere that you'd be working. But what's funny is I have all these ex-athletes, and I might do a segment or talk with them, and they'll say, oh, you know, when I had this, this is what happened to me. And so I learn a lot by talking with them as well in terms of how things used to be managed versus how they are currently. And it's been a great platform, really. One of the things that ESPN has allowed me to do is be creative with this. And there's stories, you see injuries are in the news every single day. And there will always be stories to tell related to medicine in some way, shape, or form. So there's plenty of opportunity there.
Yeah, I'm surprised you don't have a treatment table set up in your office in ESPN.
If I did, it would be in use all the time. So we stay away from that. But it's interesting because I do have a manual therapist that's not far away from our headquarters. And she does a lot of Pilates-based rehab. And I've sent people to her. And it has helped. I think it helps bring an awareness, which is important for me as far as credibility. So I send them to a really good manual therapist. And they come back and, you know, in their mind, they're thinking, oh, wow, I had a really good experience with a physical therapist. That must mean physical therapists really know what they're doing. And, you know, that helps. That in turn helps me. So
that's a big positive. That's like, that's top notch. I mean, the best compliment a patient can give me is that I had no idea that physical therapists, you know, did this or could be this useful, or nobody's ever done this, you know, with me before, or I've been to physical therapy before, but wow, this was different. That's kind of, I take that as the best compliment anybody can give.
Right, and a lot of people still don't know how they can access a PT or that they can go to PT for certain things. So I'm constantly referring my coworkers out to PT. And when they have a good experience, I feel like that helps me in my job because they're thinking, Oh, I know what tea is now. I had this really positive experience with it. So, yeah, let's have Stefania talk about this. You know, it's funny how it translates, but I think it's important as professionals. You're always thinking about that. This every time somebody has an interaction or experience with a PT and they come away with a positive thought, you never know how that will carry forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's especially the manual therapy world that I would say majority of people don't even know exists. I think we as a physical therapy profession are so widespread and so multi-talented that, you know, manual therapy is a subset of a specialty of orthopedics. So I think most people still don't really know what manual therapy is. And it really is a different beast compared to most other treatment philosophies.
I agree. So, you know, getting them out there and the more exposure that people have to it, the better, because that word of mouth, you know, there's no better advertising than that, right?
Absolutely. And but more importantly right now, how's your fantasy team looking?
Next question. I was in the playoffs in one league and I just lost last night, based on Baltimore defense didn't
Justin
get
Justin Tucker got you?
No, I just needed a little more out of Baltimore defense than I got, so I had to concede in that one. And I've got another one where I'm still in the mix for the overall points title, and then three other leagues I just had some mediocre finishes. One league. Do you guys play, by the way?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Do you ever have that team where no matter what choice you make, whoever you start, it was the wrong decision? Like, constantly, whoever was on my bench had the better day. It was I could not make a right decision. And unfortunately, this is a league I play in with a bunch of the suits at ESPN, so it was really not the ideal place to have the ultra poor performance of my life. But I have won that league. I'm a former champion of it, so I don't let them forget that in case they think I'm, you know, incompetent at my fantasy football component of my job.
But I expect nothing less from you.
Terrible, terrible performance in that league this year. I'm just completely ready to move on. But yeah, I still have a couple things to play for, but I'm not going to have any championship titles this year. Very disappointing.
Yeah, I'm in the championship for my league, but I had a team that I should have been undefeated. I mean, it was if I told you the players on my team, you'd say how is it even a question that you're in the finals? But I had a stretch of games, like four games in the middle of the year, where I played against a team that had a player that had a career game.
Right.
Like I had Alshon Jeffries
of this week, right?
Exactly. The first game of the season I played against Peyton Manning and he had 7 touchdowns. I'm like, this is how it's going to be.
It's so unfair, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah, speaking of Peyton Manning, he's looked really good after that fusion.
He has, and you know, a big shout out to his physical therapist Aaron Burrell, who is with the Colts, who worked with Peyton, unsung hero in all of this, but worked with him extensively when Peyton was with the Colts rehabbing. You know, that's where the bulk of his rehab happened, was in Indianapolis before he was traded to Denver. And that Aaron knew Peyton for years because Peyton had only ever been with the Colts, and Aaron worked amazingly with him to get him back. So, you know, there are a lot of these PTs who really have helped these athletes behind the scenes, and they don't look for, they don't ask for, they don't get a ton of credit, but they're really a big reason why they're back. And you heard a lot about Peyton and his throwing coach, and he was working out with at Duke, but in order for him to get to the point where he could even throw, that all of that happened in the early days of PT.
Yeah, I think I know. Us, at least, at C, fusion surgeries, a lot of post-MVAs are really bad degenerative conditions, and you see patients going through it, then you make that translation to playing football with 300-400-pound men running after you. That's just incredible and terrifying at the same time.
It really is unbelievable. I think it speaks to him. It was nice, you know, he just won the Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year, and gave a lot of credit to his wife for pushing him, and things that Peyton does not usually admit to, but he talked about wondering if he was done after the injury, when he really wasn't seeing the return in his arm that he wanted, and how she encouraged him and kind of pushed him through. So to catch a little glimpse, I mean, people think, well, of course he's a pro, so he did it and he got back. But I think it was kind of nice to see that for anybody who might be going through some similar surgery and recovery, to see that it wasn't always so easy for him, that he did have those tough moments where he wasn't sure he'd get back to doing this, and yet he overcame it. And part of that is because of who he is. But it really is quite a story.
Yeah, he seems like a pretty motivated and driven guy. But to be fair, has he been tackled yet this year, though? I don't know.
Well, you know, and he's dealing with a high ankle sprain injury that's causing him a lot more problems this year. But I think one of the things about Peyton being such an intelligent player is he understood how this would impact him. I mean, he was not going to be the same guy in his late 30s coming off of this injury that he was in his 20s. So he had to make adjustments, including making sure he got rid of the ball quicker, because he could not be a guy who was getting hit time and time again. And I think that he's proven that he can play that way and be quite good.
Yeah, I think we were kind of spoiled with that too over here with us in Baltimore, and Ravens fans with watching Ray Lewis for so many years and kind of going kind of the same thing, understanding the game so well that you really put yourself in those positions, and kind of like Tony Gonzalez, where you talked about earlier, is just being methodical with the training and understanding the holistic aspect of maintaining your body.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's always going to be those guys who sort of are the cream that rises to the top, because they do everything they can to keep themselves going. But it's a nice illustration that you don't have to be defined by an injury.
Absolutely. And can't think of a better way to finish out than that. It's all about the mindset, and an injury is just a place and time that you'll move on from.
Absolutely. With the help of your PTs, of course.
Of course.
Hey, there you go.
She's in the media, Joe. She knows how to close these things out.
That's right. I'd like to think so by now. One never knows. But we didn't get any, we didn't happen to slip up and say anything. I know you guys were waiting for it, but none of that happened in this hour anyway.
Well, I will continue watching. I will be diligently watching for you to slip
Stephanie,
up with a medical term.
I'm always rooting for you.
I'm not sure how to take this. I'm always rooting for you to succeed.
Gene, I don't know what he's talking about.
I hope you're not planting some subliminal message that's then going to crop up. If I have trouble on Sunday's show, I'm going to blame it on you.
You wouldn't be the first, and definitely not the last, to blame something on me. So I'm used to it. But thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure talking with you. I know our fans and our listeners will enjoy the conversation and kind of getting a glimpse in the world of professional sports.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time and your insight. It was great.
Thanks very much for having me. It's always fun to talk physical therapy and sports injuries and all that. I could do this all day long. So, well, I do actually do it all day long, but it's nice, nice to talk with my peers about it, because that is the one thing I don't get to do very often anymore. So I really appreciate you inviting me on.
So for our listeners, where can they find your blogs, your information, Twitter, anything?
Yeah. So my Twitter handle is Stefania_ESPN. And if you care about breaking news injuries, I'm tweeting usually about that. If you go to ESPN.com/fantasy, I do have a blog that posts there, but I have a number of pieces on the site that are not necessarily tied to fantasy from time to time, and some of the interviews that we've done, some of the features. I did a piece on Dr. Job that meant a great deal to me. I was fortunate enough to spend time with him and then attend the ceremonies at Cooperstown, where he was recognized by the Baseball Hall of Fame this year for his contributions to the sport of baseball. And that's one of the pieces I'm most excited about. If you wanted to go back and read that, just sort of how the Tommy John surgery came about and his relationship with Tommy John, and what it's done for baseball. That is something that I wrote that's on the site. But essentially, most of my work can be found on ESPN, just navigating the site. So
yeah, it's fantastic stuff. And like I said, do yourselves a favor, read the Achilles article. It was fantastic, just like everything else. So once again, thank you, Stefania Bell, for joining us on Therapy Insiders. And as always, if you guys have any questions, send us any comments at therapyinsiders@gmail.com. On Therapy Insiders on Twitter and Therapy Insiders on iTunes. So for Joe Palmer and myself, thanks again for listening.